Anyone who has ever been a success or any company that has risen from an ordinary or a mediocre company to a great company has embraced the Stockdale paradox. In his book, Good to Great, a man by the name of Jim Collins, he's written a couple of books, I read both of them several years ago, and was taken by this one story, and this has to do about the Stockdale paradox. Let me give this to you as he writes it. It goes like this. You must maintain unwavering faith that you can and will prevail in the end, regardless of the difficulties, and at the same time have the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. The name, Stockdale Paradox, with that principle that I just gave you, is a name that refers to Admiral Jim Stockdale, who was the highest-ranking United States military officer in the Hanoi Hilton prisoner of war camp during the height of the Vietnam War, tortured over 20 times during his eight-year imprisonment from 1965 to 1973. Stockdale lived out the war without any prisoner's rights, no set release date, and no certainty as to whether he would even survive to see his family again. He shouldered the burden of command, doing everything he could to create conditions that would increase the number of prisoners who would survive unbroken while fighting an internal war against his captors and their attempts to use the prisoners for propaganda. At one point, he beat himself with a stool and cut himself with a razor, deliberately disfiguring himself so he could not be put on videotape as an example of a well-treated prisoner. He exchanged secret intelligence information with his wife through their letters, knowing that discovery would mean more torture and perhaps death. He instituted rules that would help people to deal with torture. No one can resist indefinitely, so he created a stepwise system. After X amount of minutes, you can say certain things that gave the men milestones to survive toward. He instituted an elaborate internal communication system to reduce the sense of isolation that their captors tried to create, which used a 5x5 matrix of tap codes for alpha characters. Tap, tap equals the letter A. Tap, pause, tap, tap equals the letter B. And tap, tap, pause, tap equals the letter F. And so on for 25 letters, C doubling for K. At one point, during an imposed silence, the prisoners mopped and swept the central yard using the code, swish, swashing, out in their movements, "We love you," to Stockdale, on the third anniversary of his being shot down. After his release, Stockdale became the first three-star officer in the memory of the Navy to wear both aviator wings and the Congressional Medal of Honor. Now, this particular author, Jim Collins, says he was able to spend an afternoon with Stockdale in preparation for the interview, and he read the book Stockdale and his wife wrote, In Love and War, each writing alternating chapters chronicling their experiences during those 8 years. He says, as I moved through the book, I found myself getting depressed. It just seemed so bleak. The uncertainty of his fate, the brutality of his captors, and so forth. Looking out over the beautiful Stanford, California campus on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, I'm getting depressed reading this, and I know the end of the story. I know he gets out, reunites with his family, and becomes a national hero, and gets to spend his latter years with his wife, studying philosophy on the very same beautiful campus. If it feels depressing for me, how on earth did he deal with it when he was actually there and did not know the end of the story? He says, I never lost faith in the end of the story, he said, when I asked him. I never doubted not only that I would get out, but also that I would prevail in the end and turn the experience into a defining event of my life, which in retrospect, I would not trade. I didn't say anything for many minutes, and we continued the slow walk toward the faculty club, Stockdale limping and Ark swinging his stiff leg that had never fully recovered from repeated torture. Finally, after about 100 meters of silence, I asked, "Who didn't make it out?" "Oh, that's easy," he said. "The optimist." "The optimist? I don't understand," I said, now completely confused, given what he had said 100 meters earlier. "The optimist. Oh, they were the ones who said we're going to be out by Christmas, and Christmas would come and go. And then they would say we're going to be out by Easter, and Easter would come, and Easter would go. And then Thanksgiving, and it would be Christmas again. And they died of a broken heart." Another long pause and more walking. And then he turned to me and said, "This is a most important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be." To this day, I carry a mental image of Stockdale admonishing the optimist, "We're not going to get out by Christmas. Deal with it." Now, that conversation with Admiral Stockdale stayed with me, and in fact had a profound influence on my own development. Life is unfair, sometimes to our advantage, sometimes to our disadvantage. We will all experience disappointments and crushing events somewhere along the way, setbacks for which there is no reason, no one to blame. It might be a disease. It might be injury. It might be an accident. It might be losing a loved one. It might be getting swept away in a political shakeup. It might be getting shot down over Vietnam and thrown into a POW camp for 8 years. What separates people, Stockdale taught me, is not the presence or the absence of difficulty, but how they deal with the inevitable difficulties of life. In wrestling with life's challenges, the Stockdale paradox: you must retain faith that you will prevail in the end, and you must also confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, has proved powerful for coming back from difficulties not weakened, but stronger, not just for me, but for all those who have learned the lesson and tried to apply it. The principle, stated again: retain faith, maintain faith that you will prevail in the end, regardless of the difficulties, and at the same time confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. Now, the Stockdale paradox is a signature of all those who will succeed, full stop. Not just succeed whether or not you have difficulties to overcome, because everybody does. That's a part of the process, that you face the brutal facts. It doesn't matter if you are leading your own lives or you are leading others. Churchill had it during the Second World War. Admiral Stockdale, like Viktor Frankl, who was in a Jewish concentration camp in Germany before him, lived it out in the prison camp. And while good to great companies cannot claim to have experienced either the grandeur of saving the free world or the depth of personal experience of living at a POW camp, they all embraced the Stockdale paradox. It didn't matter how bleak the situation or how stultifying the mediocrity, they all maintained unwavering faith that they would not just survive, but prevail as a great company. And yet, at the same time, they became relentlessly disciplined at confronting the most brutal facts of their current reality. You have to operate from both sides of the paradox, never letting one side overshadow the other. Now, this is precisely the point to where Christ is leading all of us and where he has led us, especially at the time of conversion. Conversion cannot begin unless you do these two things. And these two things, one might say, is what compromises repentance and then leads to true conversion. It's a place where you must start. We have to come to the place where we face the most brutally honest reality of ourselves. We have to understand the situation we are in. The truth of the matter is that we were locked into an ever downward spiral of hopelessness, never able to come to get ourselves out of it. And at the end of that road we were on, awaited only darkness and death without any redemption at hand. The other side is that someone came along and gave us hope and changed our direction to where at the end of that road would await everything we could ever want and everything we would ever hope for. But directions in life are not changed unless you come to the point of confronting the brutal facts of our situation. I hope that we all, at that one point of conversion, came to see something in such a way that we never saw it before. And it kind of goes like this, that I am not and never was the person I thought I was. If I had not come to that point, I could never have imagined that there would be a solution, simply because I saw no need for a solution. I was always okay. It was okay. Life was okay. We all want to be okay. Accepted by our friends, having friends and family. Secure in those friendships. Secure financially and healthy. But the honest fact of the matter was, I wasn't okay with God. I wasn't accepted by him, and nowhere near his purpose, and certainly not obedient, and certainly not a good person. Repentance is coming to that point, realizing the honest facts about yourself, not according to the way other people see it, and not the way you used to see yourself, but really coming to see this and understand it. Without coming to that point, you will never go forward. Repentance is coming to that point and then knowing something can be done about it. And that something is sure. That something is permanent. And if we arrived at that starting point at one time, it is a state of mind then that we must always have. We must always understand the brutally honest truth about ourselves. At the same time, never lose faith in the outcome. The outcome is that you will prevail. Now, Jesus had to do this himself, or he would have failed. He had to face the most brutal facts, but at the same time, never lose faith that he would prevail in the end. Matthew 16, verse 21. Matthew 16, verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. He had to face the brutal truth about what was going to happen. And it's something that he chose to tell his disciples. In fact, we find over in Mark, I believe it is, around chapter 8, where it says, the third time Jesus began to tell his disciples what would happen to him when he would go to Jerusalem, and how he would suffer at the hands and then be killed and then be raised again the third day. In verse 22, then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Now you get behind me, Satan, you are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." What we see here then is that the truth, as Christ was telling him, was too much for Peter and the rest of the disciples to take. And we know that because of what happened later. They all fled and they all forsook Christ. And even though he was so frank, so honest with them, they simply couldn't bring themselves to believe what he was saying. The reality was so disturbing that they just couldn't go there mentally. It was blocked out of their minds. You see, their hope was for the short term. They did not have a long-term commitment to the kingdom of God as Jesus understood it. It was a matter of what Christ would do for them there and now, as a temporal earthly setting, that they were expecting a kingdom, a physical temporal kingdom, where they would then have some very important positions within that kingdom. That was in their thinking. And so they were looking for something quick. Not a long-term commitment, certainly nothing beyond as Christ was trying to describe to them. Now he goes on, so Jesus then says, "Now here is a more accurate picture." This is reality here. Here's the way it is. Then he said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Now he says, that's the accurate picture, not the one you have in your mind right now. I don't want you to be here under any misapprehensions. I want you to really understand that there is a long-term commitment to the kingdom, and with a hope in the end that you will indeed have everything that you ever hope for. But you have to understand, this is a marathon. It is not a sprint. This is long term. "For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." In other words, if you want something here and now, and you want something to happen for you during this life, and you're following me for that reason, you're going to be disappointed. I really want to be upfront with you guys on this. This is what he's saying to them. "For what profit is it that a man, if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" Showing that this is what people go for. They want to try to gain the world. They want to try to gain what they can have here and now. He says, "I want to let you know, this is not where it's at. And if you're going to go down that road, then you can't be my disciple. For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward each according to his works. However, I want to give you assurances." Assurances in the most absolute sense that God's glory is going to come, and everyone is going to be rewarded fully, completely, generously, according to his works. But don't think about it in the short term. If you do, it's going to be a problem for you. So Jesus confronted them with the most brutal facts then about what they would eventually face. Jesus also confronted them about themselves. He had to show them this. If you go to Matthew chapter 26, verse 31, Matthew 26, verse 31, and we see how denial plays a big part in that we, when we do not want to face up to reality. 26:31 of Matthew, then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." He even quoted scripture to prove this. This was reality. "But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered and said to him, "Even if all the rest of these are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble." And Jesus said to him, "Assuredly I say to you, this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And so said all of the disciples. So it wasn't only Peter, but all of the disciples. They couldn't bring themselves to face the horrible reality of, number one, what was going to happen to Christ, to their Christ, their Messiah that they were following. And two, they couldn't bring themselves to face the stark reality of their own weakness in the face of serious trial. Denial. They couldn't bring themselves to face this. You know, the worst thing you can do to yourself is to remain in denial about your true situation. Not to understand the truth about yourself condemns you to remain as you are. It is a recipe for failure. You will not change. You will not go forward. It simply will not happen. And it's something we resist. We really resist it because we really do not want to see ourselves as we really are. Now, Jesus faced himself. He faced it in its most horrible realism and the immediacy of the situation over in, well, as we just continue down, verse 36, same chapter. "Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to the disciples, 'Sit here while I go and pray over there.' And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed." In other words, he really wanted them to try as much as possible to get a picture, to get an accurate picture of what was going to happen. "And he said to them, 'My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me.'" And this should have been something that they should have been alarmed at, to see Jesus this way, that, wow, this is big. Something is wrong here. However, as he went a little further, he fell on his face. He prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And so he did say, if it is possible. He said, "All things are possible with you." I believe he said that in the book of Mark. "Then he said to the disciples, and he found them sleeping, and said to Peter, 'What? Could you not watch with me 1 hour?'" You know, sometimes when you're under a lot of stress, when there's something that you really don't want to come at, do you feel tired, stressed out, even sleepy? The thing to do is just go to sleep. I think it's a human mechanism. It's something the way they saw him was simply too much. How much they understood what was going to happen is another thing. They seem to have acknowledged it, but it's very doubtful that they really grasped what was taking place. "Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And a second time, he went away and prayed, saying, "O my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done." And he came and he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. And he left them, saying, went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. And when he came to his disciples, and he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Arise, let us be going. My betrayer is at hand." Jesus faced, he faced this. He saw this ahead of time. He knew what was coming, and it's in living color almost, as it were, and he understood the immediacy of what he was about to face. It was imminent. In a matter of hours, he would be experiencing extreme torture and torment, and as the hours would progress, it would get only worse, with no relief except death. But here, in the end, he rises to meet it with all confidence and purpose. You see, prayer like this has at its basis the brutal, honest truth of our situation and the truth about ourselves. Without facing the true situation, you would have no reason to pray like this. The more you see this, the more you understand it, the more fervent, the more sincere, the more heard your prayers will be. Jesus experienced the Stockdale paradox. Though let me say, he understood it. Admiral Stockdale only understood it a lot later. Jesus faced the most brutal facts of his reality, but he knew he could get through to the other side. And he knew what awaited him on the other side, and he never doubted that he would come through because of the one who would save him from death. Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 and 8 tells us this. Hebrews 5, 7 and 8. Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear. And though he was the Son, he learned obedience by the things which he suffered, and having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who would obey him. He knew he would be saved from eternal death. And that's what that's referring to, by the way, eternal death. He had to be saved from that. And so the prayer was not in the end. And the conclusion of the prayer was not, deliver me from this trial. But the prayer was, sustain me in this trial. Help me to believe. Help me to know who you are, who I am, and what the outcome will absolutely be beyond the shadow of a doubt, and that I will receive the strength to go through it. He understood the outcome. Acts chapter 2, verse 25, which was inspired by him because he knew where he had to go. He knew where he had to be. In Acts chapter 2, verses 25, for David says concerning him, and here's Peter quoting from Psalm 16, I foresaw the Lord always before my face. For he is at my right hand that I shall not be shaken. Therefore my heart rejoiced and my tongue was glad. Moreover, my flesh also will rest in hope. For you will not leave my soul in Hades or the grave, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the ways of life, and you will make me full of joy in your presence. He knew the outcome. He knew he would be saved from staying in the grave. However, for Christ, this was the way out. This was the only way out. And you had to know that it was all going to turn out right. You had to know that. You face the most brutal facts of your reality, but you never lose faith in the fact that you will prevail. Now, I want to change directions just for a moment and move from how we just understood the principle of the Stockdale paradox to a different application. So there's an aspect of this I think we should all understand, because in some way it's going to affect all of us. I want to read to you from an article that my daughter sent me on autism. I found it very interesting let me just give it to you. And I think you'll see the point as we get into it. keeping the principle of the Stockdale paradox in mind. It has to do with neurodiversity, is how they are beginning to describe certain neurological difficulties that people have. He said, this person who writes says, when I attended the International Autism Conference in London last year, I heard Professor David Amarell tell the story of a young man with Asperger's syndrome who was visiting the Mind Institute at UC Davis. He was asked what he would do if they could develop a pill for autism. He thought for a while before replying that he would take half the pill. I think this illustrates the real difference between the within the autism community. There are many who pathologize autism as a disorder that afflicts an otherwise healthy individual. If you hold this idea, you naturally look to understand the causes of autism in order to find the autism pill. The idea of neurodiversity was developed by autistic people in opposition to the pathologizing model. According to them, autistic people are not disordered. They have a different sort of order. Their brains are differently wired. They think differently. They do not want to be cured. They want to be understood. This is not to deny that autistic people often face real difficulties. That is why the young man at the Mind Institute told David Amarell that he would take half the pill, not the whole pill. What does it mean for parents? The cure mentally places great pressure on parents to rush into interventions. Then there is the guilt. Was there something I did or didn't do that caused the autism in my child? Can I put it right? How can I not put it right? Instead of raising your child, you can spend all your time trying to fix him. One mother's story illustrates this. Olivia was 4 when Liz finally faced up to the diagnosis. Racked with guilt and having given birth to her at the age of 42, she was somehow responsible for her child's problems, either directly or as a result of a prenatal diagnostic test, amniocentesis, that went wrong. Her way of dealing with this lonely burden was to take action. I wanted to rip the autism out of Olivia with my bare hands, she says. In the years that followed, she whirled her daughter from one therapist to another, trying everything from cranial osteopathy and brushing her nerve endings to portage, a method of teaching everything in tiny steps. Every practitioner is convinced that his or her treatment is the one, and you feel compelled to try everything to find the one that will open up your child. I have seen children who have made remarkable improvements, but I would never say they have ever been cured or recovered. Having reached a state of mind where, even if she could, she would not change Olivia. She tries to concentrate on the good qualities that come with autism: honesty, uncompetitiveness, absence of spite. Embracing neurodiversity allows you to stop looking for a cure because there isn't one. I agree with the autistic society that most of the enlightened world knows that autism is, at its root, genetic. Therefore, by definition, it is not something which can be considered curable or a disease. Giving up on a cure is not the same as giving up on your child. In fact, it can help you to take more of a balanced approach. It is easier to reflect on your child's strength as well as their difficulties and to take up Lorna Wing's advice that an autistic child can only be helped if a serious attempt is made to see the world from his point of view. Sometimes our biggest problem lies with other people. One mother gave me permission to quote something that she wrote in an email about autism and acceptance. I think it's a bit insulting sometimes for people, especially family and friends, to try to give me information about how to make my son be a bit less autistic. It makes me think they want to shortcut to make him more acceptable. I'd prefer it if they try to connect with him and enjoy him as he is. Then they'd really be able to help him to progress. It's not so far from the experience of lots of autistic children whose interest and talents are sidelined while we concentrate on their difficulties. This can send the wrong messages to our kids. They learned about their their limitations, but rarely get the chance to achieve. So they put up barriers to protect what is left of their self-esteem. You try to offer constructive criticism, they take it as a mortal insult. If we accept somebody and work with their strengths, we can help them to find ways of dealing with their problems that work for them. I spent a lot of time trying to solve my son's problems and make choices for him. The turning point came when Dave, a clinical psychologist, asked him to think about what he wanted. Prior to this, my son had always been encouraged to meet other people's demands and expectations. Dave was the first person to give my son explicit permission to put his desires before our expectations. You know, autism is one of these issues that we're going to have to face a lot of. 1 in 20 are born autistic. The condition simply is not going to change. It has increased considerably in the past few decades. They don't know exactly what causes it. Some suspect mercury that has concentrated in the fetus and is passed on stronger to the next generation. Maybe, maybe not. We do have a member of our Portland congregation who developed autism after he was an adult. And this was as a result of coming in contact with mercury. And he was then able, as an adult, to describe how he thought, how he felt, how he related, and how he understood things. And he helped other people to do this. Our grandson is autistic, and so it's not a mission. I just simply want to use this as an example, because this is not the only thing. There are many things that we will all have to deal with on a very, very long-term basis. And we tend to want a quick fix for them when there is not going to be a quick fix. However, let me put it this way. Some of us have had to face the worst thing that we could ever imagine, that the doctor comes to you and says, your baby has a problem. That is about the worst thing that can be said. A lot of people don't understand autism. I think you can understand this if I explain it this way. Let's take the ladies amongst us here. All day long, you've had one thing after another happen to you, one crisis after another. One of your children gets into a scrap at school. You've got to go to the school, and you've got to bring him home. The other child, all of a sudden, in the process, gets sick. On the way to the school, you get a fender bender, and the discussion with the school officials simply didn't go well at all. When you get home, there's a big mess on the floor from the dog. There's a baby who's cranky, and you can't do anything to alleviate that problem. The meal is ruined because of all of this, and you're so frazzled that you can barely keep control of yourself. Your husband comes home and seems rather disappointed in the situation he finds, and wonder what you've been doing all day. And you can guess what happens then. Things don't go too well. The bombardment that you get all day and you end up like this at the end of the day, these kids wake up like this every morning. They start the day like this. They experience all day like this. They work so hard just to stay in control of their lives. Anything out of order, anything different, transitioning from one thing to another, anything that's not as they expected becomes a major crisis. And they have to work hard, or event after event, one sensitivity to another sensitivity, just to maintain control. Everything that you and I take for granted that doesn't bother us, wouldn't think that it would, is enormous for them. I take my hat off to them. They have to be taught control. Indeed, they do. And I have to hand it to those who have autistic children. I know my son-in-law, whenever my grandson begins to have a meltdown, as we call it, he'll get a hold of him. And he'll look him in the eye, and he'll make him gain control. You have to do this. You have to talk with him. And the ordinary ways that you and I might tend to use to bring children into some kind of control of themselves simply don't work. You got to learn what does work. Oh, they have a fight. They have a battle on their hands. I see on Thursday or Friday down at the Sunnybank Hills Shopping Center, there are parents and sometimes caregivers. They will bring the autistic children in. They will bring those with cerebral palsy, some of very, very serious cases. You may have seen it yourself. On some days, they're there. And I have to take my hat off to the parents. I have to take my hat off to the caregivers because some parents can't handle it. They have put their children in institutions and they have to go on with their life, but they haven't stayed with it. So then the state, in some way, or some private agency then has to take over. However, you can see them. I was in the men's room yesterday, happened to go in there, and there was one of the caregivers, actually, and he had four autistic boys with him, taking them all to the bathroom at the same time. That was quite, I saw the signs immediately. There was nothing. I thought they may have been his children. Then I saw their actions. I saw how they moved. I saw how they responded to things. I saw how they listened to him and how they responded to him. I knew immediately he had autistic children. You can see the signs. They were there. And he had to explain, tell them, talk to them, and be very patient to get them to do everything in a certain procedure, in a certain order, to be successful to go to the toilet. Now, do we know how to deal then with long-term problems? If they aren't fixed, then we tend to think there's something wrong with us, or say there's something wrong with a person. People want quick fixes. People in the church want healings, and they want healings right away. Because maybe we've conditioned ourselves to the fact that that's the way it ought to be. You know, one thing people like this learn, that this is not a sprint. This is a marathon. This is long term. This is the way it is. We have to face the brutal facts sometimes of our reality, and we've got to learn to live with it. Now, do you intervene? Well, yes, of course you do. And there are therapies, as the girl or the lady said in what I just read to you. And there are some therapies that are better, but you have to make those choices. And so then there's training. Training for who? Training for you, the parent, to learn how to deal with it, to learn what to do. And you have to change, not only that, you have to change your life. You have to change your life so that you can be a part of the training so they can begin to communicate with you. You have to change your lifestyle. You have to face reality, and you have to deal with the issue. So many families with conditions like that really like to think they're normal. You might say, wow. Why'd you say that? We try to be normal. We want to be normal. We want to be thought of as normal. But we're not. Let's don't put on the front. Let's face reality. We're not normal. We've got issues. We've got serious issues. Let's confess we have issues. See, if you don't see on an ordinary basis the process of what's taking place in you, in your own life, you won't appreciate what's taking place in the life of other people. I think we can be a lot more patient. I think we can have a long-term commitment. People like this do have to count the cost. And frankly, I think we all have to count the cost. You know what? You know another word for counting the cost is, like Jesus said to do? Face the brutal facts of your reality. That's what he meant by that. Face it. Otherwise, you don't have a correct accounting of the cost. Know what's ahead. Deal in reality. See, how would people feel who were the ones who weren't healed? That's inevitable. The ones who are healed are celebrities. The people with long-term illnesses, people don't understand them, or their situation, or their condition. People will offer solutions and remedies for you, well-meaning, but people are thinking more about themselves. We need to have a commitment toward people with long-term difficulties. Now, we have a lot, we're going to face this more and more. And for people to hope for medical science to come up with a solution in their lifetime with some of these conditions is a mindset for failure. This is the way it is. This is the brutal, honest facts of the matter. Do we have a commitment to our situations, or do we want a solution right now? And do we embrace the truth of God, or do we attend a church because we so desperately want to have a change in our circumstances? We want something to happen for us. And when some people don't find what they're looking for, maybe in one church, well, we'll just find another and hope they will find it there. It never happens. Do you have a commitment to your family? Do you have a commitment to your marriage? Do you have a long-term commitment to the purpose of God? Do you have a long-term commitment to your church? Or do you have unrealistic expectations like everything will always be made right and I will never have to worry about trying situations? The way we deal sometimes with situations is to jump ship. I'll simply go somewhere else. And guess what goes with you? Your problems. Now, some of us are going to have long-term conditions if we don't already have one or several. Some of our situations had their beginnings since we were children, or we were born with a condition, or we have the genes for a condition, or we have an exposure to harmful substances, or we were abused as a child, or we were denied love and acceptance that was needed for a sound upbringing, and we're still trying to come to terms with that. We're people who look for a quick fix, the healing. We look for all things to be made right, and if it doesn't happen, then something must be wrong. I must be wrong. I must be flawed. And so we try to find what is wrong. And we even tend to believe the worst. We are horribly wrong. And in this, we can be our own worst enemy. We want to have it fixed. We become angry when it isn't. And we become angry that others don't understand. And we become angry and tend to alienate those who can help us. And we go into a downward spiral where the real solution is carry your cross. We can't get away from that. That's what he said. Carry your cross, your burden. And now let's get on with life. For some things, there is no quick fix. If there is, well, then I'm sure we'll find it. But at the same time, do we have a commitment? Luke 23, there is such a story with the two men who were crucified with Christ. Luke 23:39. Then one of the criminals who were hanged, that is hanging on the stake, blasphemed him, saying, "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." What did he want? Do it now. Sure, you can save us. But the other, answering, rebuked him, saying, "Do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? We indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And then he said to Jesus, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus said to him, "Assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise," or as we more properly understand it, "I say unto you today, you will be with me in paradise." It certainly wasn't going to be that day. Both of them, including Jesus, would be in the grave that day. And in the case of Jesus, for two more days after that. So it certainly wasn't going to be literally that day. But one of the criminals had the good fortune to be crucified. Let me finish the statement. He had the good fortune to be crucified next to the one who could do something for him. And he recognized that the only way out of this was to be given a chance in the next life. Because look what this life got him into. He faced the brutal facts of the situation. I am a criminal. I am getting exactly what I deserve. Nothing is going to change this. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. The other one demanded a save me now approach to Christ. It just wasn't going to happen. We have to see things for what they are. At the same time, we have to have absolute, unwavering faith in how it is all going to turn out. Jesus, I believe, gave us the reality. He helps us to face up to it, and I believe He leads us to the truth. Always, always to the stark, the brutal, and to the honest truth about ourselves and to our situation. But He always, always leaves us with a hope and with a faith that you're going to prevail. And you will prevail because I have prevailed. And I have prevailed because of the Father. You know, I could go on and on in the Bible where I find this principle stated and illustrated, but where this principle is either employed or not employed, that we're calling the Stockdale paradox. You know, if you would read the Bible trying to keep that in mind, I think you would find more instances of that than you would ever imagine. I believe Abraham came to this. He understood, you know, this is long term. And so, in Genesis chapter 15, he said, "I have Eliezer. He's going to be my heir." And the Lord said, "Not so. It's going to come from your own loins." And then he said, "Right." And so Sarah gave him Hagar. And the Lord said, "Not so. Not only that, but your descendants are going to be 430 years oppressed by somebody else. And then they're going to come back into the land." Should you have a long-term commitment or not? There we are. It is indeed long-term. So long-term, we find in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 13. These all died in faith. They didn't die in hopelessness. They died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And what they're saying, what I get here and now on this earth is not where it's at. Let us face the brutal reality. This is what he says. I know a lot goes on in the Christian religion today that tells you the opposite. It gives you a different impression. The fact of the matter is that anything we receive from Him at this time is a bonus. And He is prepared to bless us. And He is prepared to give to us everything that is needed. Even if it is in the midst of trials, He will give you exactly what you need to have at that time. Let's conclude with these few statements. I do wonder how many of us really face up to the fact of the way things really are. That we do have the correct picture of our own situation before God. That we really have a correct picture of the way things are, the way we are. Not before men, not what men think of us, not our own status amongst men. That's fanciful. That is not reality. But how we are before God. That is the ultimate reality. And that's what you and I will always have to face. How many of us are the optimist, thinking that all is going to change for the better in a very short time? Things will get better by the feast. Things will change at the time of the Passover. This will happen and that will happen. And how many of us have absolute and unwavering faith that God is in complete control, He has a purpose, and will even cause the most impossible situation to turn out for His glory and for our reward? We have to have unwavering faith that in the end, we will prevail. You will survive. You will prevail. But you have to face. I'm sorry, you have to embrace the Stockdale paradox. You must maintain unwavering faith that you can and will prevail in the end, regardless of the difficulties, and at the same time, have the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be.